Now, I'd be totally lying if I didn't realize at some point in time that the higher up you are, the more influence you have. And that's actually a very cute delusion, because then you realize that that's not true either. Because corporate world doesn't operate this way. And I'd realize that all of us, and actually it's really through the personality and the energy that you really give off, that people follow that, and that you can make the biggest change that way.
You are a driven international professional or manager, have achieved quite a bit already, but are asking yourself from time to time, what do I really want? How do I want to work and live? Then this is your podcast. I am Gina Friedrich, career and life coach for people who want to actively shape their future. Every second Thursday, I release interviews for you with inspiring, successful, as well as renowned international personalities from the world of business, NGO, and sports. They all will share with you what these questions mean to them, how they handled obstacles in their lives, and shaped their journey to where they are today. You are curious and don't want to miss anything? Sign up for this podcast right here. And now, let yourself be inspired on your very personal journey towards the future that you wish for. Hi there! Welcome to episode 31. I am super happy to have you here with me. Today, you will hear the story of Anna Maria Clemens, an HR transformation expert with quite a colorful background and journey. She was born in Poland, and her professional path brought her from Canada to Tokyo and to many, many more countries in the world. She held HR management positions at Accenture, Syngenta, and lately the GEA Group, worked as a professional dancer, and managed schools. She will talk with us about this journey, why she has left her home country to follow her talents, and how for the first time in her life the question, "Who am I really?" arised. Anna Maria very openly shares how some people would tell her that she had no focus in her career, how she was worrying about being behind of others from top universities and her English not being good enough in the corporate world, but also what she specifically learned from that time. We talk about her experiences where none of the corporate games were working anymore, about aha moments and taking a break from her professional career, why she only did well when she could deeply connect to herself and others, and her learnings on cultural adjustments, you'll also hear now. And here she is. Anna Maria, welcome. And yeah, it's great to have you as our guest today. Thanks for sharing some experiences with us today during this episode.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me. It's really great to be here.
Yeah, I hope you had a good day so far. And I was wondering if there was something that made you smile today already.
Wow, there are so many things. I've been up a little bit earlier today and watched the sunrise after my meditation.
Wow.
And, you know, just, I don't know, just looking at the trees bending under the wind, you know, makes me smile. But I also had a very beautiful text from my friend from Basel that is quite special. So that'll put an extra big smile on my face.
Wow. And for those listening, we just have noon. How amazing. And I was just thinking that the other day I did my yoga and meditation also while it just got brighter outside. I did not have that before. So maybe I should wake up even earlier to see the sunrise. Maybe it's a good idea. Thanks for sharing this.
You're welcome.
If we would ask your closest friend to describe the person, Anna Maria Clemens, what would he or she tell us?
Wow. That's an interesting question, because I've had so many different friends in different cultures, in different, you know, times in my career, and none of them been with me throughout my life. Mm-hmm. But I have actually asked that to people just as an experiment and as part of my development, my own development. I think the three questions they would have said that I'm generally quite joyful. Some people used to call me perky. You know, it really depends on whom. Quite, I guess, insightful about the surrounding of me, not necessarily about myself early on in my life, not as aware, but aware about how things work around and the people that are. And quite resilient, I would say. My life been quite vibrant or turbulent, depends how you want to look at it. So that kind of quality helped me come through, to where I am today.
Wow. And yeah, you just mentioned turbulent time. Yeah, when I have sent you the leading questions of this podcast series, like what is my path? What do I really want? What was the first thing or thought that you've had?
I was thinking, actually, I looked at your questions and I thought, how am I going to answer that? Because I never thought about my life or a path in my life, but they have been a prevailing theme to my life. And perhaps, you know, would help to understand where I was born and how did this question and the theme came about. Mm-hmm. So I have been always about a sense of freedom. I always wanted to experience life and be free to do so. And if there was a path, I wanted to understand two things, and that's since very young child. And I am currently doing some work with my mother. She's the only person in my family to verify certain experiences. But those two things were the truth, but like the absolute truth behind the truth. What's the truth of nature of the world? Obviously, when I ask that question, you know, in my young adulthood, or actually childhood, I had the different levels of, you know, the levels of the truth I was seeking.
Yeah, and what a big question to ask. Wow.
Yeah, my mother found me very, let's just say, why do you ask this question? She was very a special woman, or she still is. And the other one was, it was the nature, the true nature of love. You know, what people mean when they say I love you. Since I was quite young, I understood that they mean it, but they don't necessarily behave it or embody it. And, you know, so I was born in Poland, behind the Iron Curtain still, in a family that happened to be on the wrong side of the of the government and so on. And my father went through the war. And I couldn't quite understand, you know, the kind of different sort of truth that were coming out. And also people would say, you know, I love you, you know, but them I want gone, or I want, you know, literally kill them. In 81, there was martial law in Poland. So that really made me think, something's not quite right. There has to be an answer to this question. And now I'm still, I think I'm getting closer, but, you know. So my life unfolded, I think, on that path, and the rest of it were just means to an end to really have a life.
And the freedom that you have mentioned before throughout life.
The freedom was important because, you know, from the country that I was born into and the roots, I have some German roots in my family, right now raised in Poland, left to under the... you know, under the communists, and maybe a little criminal background. I left on 5-day visa and never came back, you know. My father actually didn't know, my mother knew, but when they both worked out, you know, that I had done that, they were like, well, you know, give her 6 months, she'll come back. Well, here I am, and I haven't. But, you know, because I think a lot of people left when they seek a better economical, you know, background, or they're really just avoiding a certain, you know, political setup, but they yearn for the country. I have never had that, you know. So when people say, I live here, but I miss, you know, X, Y, Z, I never understood it, because if I miss something, then why wouldn't I go there, be there, you know? I never understood the should and would and kind of questioning. And as a result, I haven't really suffered from that kind of nostalgia, like Chopin, for example, has, but I mean, you know, no comparison.
Thanks for sharing this. I mean, this really was a very, special experience then that you and your family went through. But looking at your professional path, it shows a very colorful picture. So you were a professional dancer, you managed schools, HR transformations and sales programs and much more. Was there any key moment that brought you closer to your own path from step to step?
Yes, basically it depends how you look at actually what you just described. I think some people, especially in Germany or France, would say that, you know, I had no focus to my career. You know, people spend 20 years in the same company, in the same path. I guess, again, for me, it was, so it is absolutely true. Actually, a couple of things. So yes, I was a professional ballroom dancer. And, you know, when I left, that was the idea. I would go, I would get live in Canada, have sponsorship, and I would become, you know, somebody. But really, I was going to be a professional dancer. But then, you know, I met a guy, falling in love, went to Tokyo. So then I found, okay, so who am I really? And I followed sort of my intuition on my skills and, you know, talents, whatever you want to call them. I love languages, so I thought, okay. So I then later worked in Japan and I studied full-time Japanese. And then my life brought me to the UK because, you know, when you join your life with someone, I don't believe in compromises, but I believe in, you know, following the path then together. And then you find a path for yourself that, you know, is in parallel to your partner. So coming to the UK actually was the true start of my sort of corporate career. I liked working with people. I like change. Having said that, you know, this is funny because whenever I dive into another change, I'm almost like, oh, I don't like change. But at the same time, I can't live without it. So it's taken me 40 years to work out, you know, why this is happening to me. So I joined Accenture in the sort of initial stages of setting up a company, joint venture with BT called ePeopleServe. And it was an amazing experience because I was a bit behind my peers, you know, dancing around. I actually felt a bit, oh my gosh, you know, my English isn't good enough. These people are Oxford, Cambridge, they are partners and, you know, 10 years ahead of me or 6, 7, whatever I was behind. But, you know, it was an amazing ground for me to really learn not only HR outsourcing, HR transformation, but I saw also a very collective, sort of specific collective of people setting up, and that stayed with me actually since then, an area where it almost felt like a bunch of friends were setting up a company and working with joy. So I experienced working and, you know, an energy of joy once I overcame my little insecurities. And I was learning from them. And then it took me around 2-3 years time. And I don't want to name the individual, but there was a very special lady at that time in my life. And 2 or 3 other people too. But she was very special. And she took me aside and said, hey, you know, if you need to adjust a bit. You know, what I was doing, coming from Tokyo, I felt okay. In Japan, I adjusted to the culture very well because, you know, they're Japanese. I'm European kind of looking. You know, they have a very specific culture, so I adjusted very well. In fact, my Japanese was so good that if I spoke over the phone, you couldn't really hear the difference.
Wow,
so
really?
So here, when I came to Europe...
This is unbelievable.
Yeah, it is a bit unbelievable. But basically, coming back to what I did in the UK, I came and I started, you know, looking objectively at the culture and picking points that I really didn't like about it. And rather than just, you know, let it be and absorb it, I picked a fight almost, you know, you can't be like this because I don't like it. So it's almost like trying to fit a US plug into a British one and vice versa. And it took me around 2.5 years to run out of steam. So I'm really grateful to all my friends in the UK who, you know, watched me go through this process and lovingly supported me no matter how rude I was about, you know, their own culture. Because I wanted to explore, you know, but you say these things, but you don't mean this, you know, that's rude. And it's quite funny. Accenture in my career been very important. But again, there wasn't an aha moment. I just wanted to be part of something, build something, transform something. Mm-hmm. So you could say working with people, helping them grow and develop, me growing as a result of that transforming, you know, that was always the theme that attracted me. If there was an energy of that in a specific group, I would stay with them. But it had to be a positive energy, kind of, you know, now reflecting back, I wasn't aware of that consciously in the past. But they had to be well-meaning towards each other. And when that kind of way of working, you know, disappears to a degree that the majority of the collective either no longer has the courage to be this way or just, you know, you step into a culture, there's a huge change, then I can no longer, I'm no longer willing really to be placed in such an environment because... it's just not worth it. We only have one life. So I choose now my experiences.
Mm-hmm. But and just actually, sorry, if I could just jump in with one question. It seems like from everything you have just talked us through right now, that with all these many changes, you are a quite flexible person who easily adjusts to new challenges and settings. What would you say was a key reason, or what helped you taking them on and succeeding in all these new changes and steps you took?
Huh. I've never reflected on that. I think it just really, it was this, that moment, it goes back all the way to dancing, and then the moment when I was 10 years old almost, the moment of being fully alive in the moment and being sort of aware of life in that particular moment. Mm-hmm. And then it really doesn't matter what you're doing, as long as it feels, you know, right and joyful, as it, you know, gives you passion, and as long as also it can be interpersonal, that it's good for me and others. So whether I'm doing a culture change in BP for this company that I work for, whether I am doing an HR outsourcing project, that will always remain. And you know, the skill set isn't really that far off, you know. So when you really look at this, I'm an HR transformational expert, HR, you know, I've been doing Ulrich model since 2000, right? And I know some companies are only discovering it now. So it doesn't really matter. Culture change definitely fascinated me because I've lived in so many different cultures. And also, you know, running projects, HR projects, even in the same company, sort of supposed to have the same culture. And that's actually interesting itself, because Accenture sort of had the same culture all over globally. Other companies I've never seen really be that uniform in their own corporate culture. And what I'd realized is that I would send people the same information, give them the same thing, but every country would approach it in a slightly different way. So, you know, at the risk of sounding very, putting people in the boxes and caricatures, but I really have noticed that, you know, how Dutch behave, how Germans behave, how Swiss behave, how Americans behave, very different. And they really very differently to the same deck of slides and information about what they need to do. And so I could now predict what's going to happen when I send that, right? collectively, so I would be able to anticipate that. And I love working that, you know, in this environment. I think the most rewarding kind of piece of corporate work that I did, it was with the company called Syngenta. Nothing to do with the company itself and my job, the company, of course. We went to for a month on a charity sort of work called Growing Together with VSO. Sort of how people have grown, and I've seen, you know, and I still am in touch with one of those people. He's still with the company. And I've looked sort of after him in sort of co-coaching, you know, environment or at the beginning coaching. And I've seen them grow, because when we sometimes are in the corporate world, it becomes almost cynical corporate game, especially in HQ. And I think leadership development really needs to step up a gear, you know, to bring more real development to people, to link it more to the inner world, into the, you know, if you look at people such as Richard Barrett, he talks about normal human ego development stages and links them to human levels of consciousness and leadership consciousness. And it's absolutely fundamental, you know, because there's no point investing in leadership models when we have leaders, and we have leaders at that sort of level who have unmet needs. So, you know, no matter how much we throw leadership development at those people, it's never real for them. You know, you can train them. And I've had a guy say to me, you know, but you need to be this way and that way. And usually they describe you from their perspective, because if they see you behave in a certain way, they only see from their self perspective of how they feel. They think you feel the same way as they do, just because you display similar on the outside seemingly behavior. But what happened in Bangladesh, sort of I did a big round around, I'm not very good at keeping concise. These people jumped, I think, at least, you know, 5 to 10 years level of development and maturity in that one, you know, month, because we had a very tough intellectual task to achieve. But none of these little corporate games and familiar environments were actually working anymore, and they were not of help. They had to truly drop everything that they've been. And some of the people cried, you know, I mean, literally. And I shouldn't laugh, really, because it was very hard for everybody, especially that we were escorted under gunpoint and, you know, and it wasn't safe for us. But that's what, you know, but that's what I mean. And I think when I really look back at my career, if there was something really truly that an aha moment, I can tell you that I only did well when I could deeply connect to myself and others. The moment it becomes a game or like, I don't know what's happening in HR at the moment. I'll give you an example. Everybody talks a lot about performance management and talent development. Mm-hmm. But what often happens is we put, and that's okay. You know, if you want to have a performance management process, just so you can rank people, so you can pay them less or more because you have a limited budget, that's fine. But let's not pretend that it is, you know, really helping the company perform better or the individual.
In a sustainable way, at least not.
Yeah. You know, it actually causes, you know, there's a lot of research there. It causes bad culture. It causes culture of fear and disgruntlement. And there's only the very few winners. And then they usually, when you look at companies and they, you know, reviews online, you find out a lot of people, you know, who talk about it. So I think there is a big shift, which I sensed. And I think I've been getting ready. All these years been getting me ready to bring this kind of thinking and mentality into the industry and into the corporate world. Now, funny enough, I just started the MSc in transpersonal psychology, consciousness and spirituality because I'm sort of taking a break from my current company. I'm going to be leaving them soon. And before I choose my next company, I'm going to choose it very carefully. And at the same time, I do want to strengthen my own coaching practice. And it's funny enough because it's whether it's in the corporate world or my own personal development or, you know, dancing world, I never felt ready until I was almost perfect. So I am actually learning to let go of that.
It's a learning that I went through as well, and I'm still on it.
I mean, not totally perfect because you wouldn't be able to, you know, dance, but I could have jumped earlier, right? Or actually, I can tell you an example. I was in Accenture and I did really well. And they said, that's it, you know, we're going to take you even higher. And I was thinking, whoa, this is happening too fast. And then I realized that actually that's a very female response. So there's another theme in my life that, you know, men don't behave this way. I think we speak a lot about it, that men held us back, but actually that's not true. You know, we also at home as a society created this environment when we demand a certain things from men. Okay, in different cultures to a different level. And then obviously the corporate world adjusted to that. So to undo this, really, it will require both investing in the leadership programs for just women to try to make them more assertive. For example, like naturally I am, it's not necessarily working for companies either. So I think I've been aware of all of this all my life. And now, you know, so that you could say this is the path of authentic, you know, person doing the best, whatever the right skills they have. And, you know, change, culture change, HR. I could have been easily in finance, but actually all the aptitude tests told me I should be a finance manager. And, which is hilarious because I really can't add up in my mind. I have to write it down.
Yeah, it seems like you really need to work for and with people. And this is not happening when you're sitting in front of numbers and papers all day long. So thank God you jumped on this train and continued. You were actually just talking about a couple of things, and a couple of these things might even have been part of this. But what catched my eye was that you took a 6-month break some time ago from your job for your training. And I personally remember when I decided to leave my job as a project lead a long time ago in a TV production company to go back to classroom to do my Fachabi, which is the university entry diploma in Germany, in order to study international business. And I still hear the sometimes critical, let's call them critical reactions of people around me, which did not always make it easy for me to follow what really drove me and consciously take the next step. Like, hey, Gina, you have such a well-paid job. How can you quit this? You might not get it back, or you're going to have less money when you're going to study full-time again. And are you sure you can make it through such a phase? And I remember that it was important to me as well, as you have also shared, to stay connected to myself, realizing that I wasn't happy anymore with what I was doing. And of course, having empowering friends and family members around me, Yeah, and today this is something that I support my clients with when they are looking for professional change and need someone to reflect on the status quo, exploring their choices and working on inner blockades in order to shape their own future. And I'm curious, how did you experience this time deciding to take a break from a professional career?
Yeah, so it's funny you should say that. For me, it was slightly different because you could call it this kind of endurance or stubbornness, with, you know, whatever, or kind of once. For me, it was brewing actually since for some time. So when I left Accenture and I went to Basel, I wanted to already take a break from my career. And then I was in the corporate world, and that was very hard. Changing from a consulting mind to corporate mind almost evaporized me, shall we say. And there's a lot of people from consulting world that land and they have to go back because they really can't manage. Corporate world works very differently. And I don't want to dwell into that because your question is different. So when I've reached a point, I was gradually kind of... I already came to terms with that. So when I pulled the plug, I pulled the plug. I already knew. And it was the same feeling when I was 11 years old. And I never forget turning around to my parents, especially my mother, because she'd allowed me certain flexibilities that, you know, other kids were perhaps not allowed. She's an academic also and very open-minded person. And I remember thinking, if I have to stay in this one city or this one country, I'm going to suffocate. And it was the same thing with my corporate job. I really didn't care about the consequences. Because the consequence of staying or going back to work then immediately, just because everything you know, was coming apart, shall we say. And actually, hilariously enough, everything that I was building up in this strategic role to build global business services, suddenly, you know, the company flipped the flop, you know, flipped the switch. Sorry. And came China, bought the company, and boom, you know. And that made me, this was the maybe second or third major realization that, wow, you know, I can pour my heart into this, but the company and the things that I've been doing are actually irrelevant because the company's changed fundamentally, you know. When it comes to that, the people remain, and I'm still in touch with some people, but making that switch, it wasn't hard. It was very easy, and I did a lot of energy work. I traveled a lot, and I took some time to study. I did my a certification, and actually I wasn't planning to go back to corporate world at all. Mm-hmm. But an opportunity came. You know, I came and met the people, and I had that feeling. You know, they really needed me. They wanted me, and I could add so much value into this harmony, bringing this department, and that's it. And I said, oh, okay, well, then I'll come back and I'll do it, because it flowed. But at that moment in time, of course, I was very concerned that, you know, what's going to happen, because at that point in time...
You mean going back to the corporate company?
No, the first time that I took the 6 months off, I actually thought I'm not going to be going back, and that was a big kind of pause in my life, because I was thinking, okay, and... You know, so like you do this full time, right? You are a full time coach. And I was thinking, what, you know, if this doesn't work out. So this was the first time in my life that I had doubts since I was, I think, quite young. Because the rest of my life was just flowing. This was the moment where I took the foot off the brake on purpose and I put the car in, you know, in neutral. And I thought, okay, so now we're going to consciously decide what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm. And what helped you to do that, to turn this feeling of doubt around?
I think a lot of connecting to myself, introspection, and getting rid of fear that I thought, what's the worst that can happen? You know, so I'm going to have to sell everything I have, downsize everything. You know, I've got so much stuff that actually I don't need it. And I still had my study books from Tokyo in my, you know, basement. So that actually helped me to get rid of a lot of things that no longer belong to my life. And then I thought, okay, I'll move in with my mother, or I buy some tiny little place, and frankly, I don't need that much. And that really made me feel free again to do what I need to do, to follow my heart.
And to know that even the worst thing that could happen is not even that bad, or at least something you would manage, and that would not be forever the case. You will still fall on both feet, and you will find a way. And I mean, there's so much stuff, so much experience you can build on. So I have a lot of clients that actually also have this, this inner blockade thinking, like what if it's not working, and all these inner doubts. But yeah, this is actually an excellent question that one should ask themselves whenever there's a situation like this, like what is really the worst thing that could happen. And most of the time it does not look that bad anymore if you really reflect on this, like you have just described.
Yeah, that's right. So actually it was, what's the root cause, what's really behind that fear, and then once you look fear in the eyes, it actually is not that scary anymore.
That's true. And you were just mentioning Japan again, and I have to jump in here now because, you have worked and lived abroad many times, but what we actually share is that we have spent some time in Tokyo, Japan, my absolutely favorite city. I was there when I was 19, and I was there for about a year, I think, and still this is the city that is most fascinating to me. I might even end up there for some time once in my life, a bit longer than this year that I had. Especially this, the respectful, caring, and considerate conduct towards each other that the people there had. It was amazing. But working in such a different culture, what would you say was your biggest challenge?
That's funny. The biggest challenge was my husband at that time I was married. not for me, for my employers, actually. Okay. He had to sign, and I kept that for a very long time, sign a paper that he fully understands the consequences of the fact that if I work, he's not going to necessarily have dinner on his table. And also we moved into Saitama-ken from Tokyo. Once I learned Japanese, so within a year I was quite fluent. And we lived in Kami Fukuoka, from Kami Hitabashi. And we were the only foreigners back then there, mm-hmm. in that particular area. So when we moved in, obviously the people were quite horrified. And like, oh my God, we have foreigners, what are we going to do with them now? Not because they were feeling, racist or anything, but it's just, it's something they haven't experienced. There were, a few challenges. Japan, it's wonderful. And I was there 92 to 95, so long, long way back. I think Japan has changed.
Yeah.
But, there was a culture of, I think, still different way of working, and then staying in a capsule hotels. There weren't, I don't think there was one for women when I was there.
It might have changed a lot, because this is something that I at least did not experience when I was there. I don't even know when that was.
Okay, well, it was not
15 years ago, by the way. Yeah, 15 years ago, roughly.
things change, but Japan has very in the midst of all this technology, there is a deep kind of spiritual presence, I think, and that's where I first found Zen Buddhism and martial arts were very similar to dancing. So I really dived into. I learned Japanese on the Dragon Ball manga. I've read every single one of them.
What a funny way to learn a new language! But you have mentioned that you're so interested in languages. So this at least did not seem to be a challenge to you. But what surprised you the most working in an Asian country?
Actually, in terms of particularly Japanese, and my view of it was that they were not exactly so efficient at all. They just spent a lot of time at work. But I think the difference was, what really surprised me the most is how they perceive the world. They have a very different way of perceiving world. Even the language is back to front. Japanese language is literally grammatically back to front. So I think that really has, I don't know, almost like cracked my head open, because when I came back to the UK, I literally felt like I had Earth in my hand. I thought nothing can surprise me. Mm-hmm. Now, until I went and lived in India for 9 months. So
I lived there for 6 months as well. That's something I didn't know about you. So interesting. I think we have to have a longer chat sometime soon. If you would know someone who's considering a professional stint abroad in an Asian country, and you seem to know many of them, is there any advice or important insight that you would share with them that could help?
I would say, learn the culture, learn the language if you can, and immerse yourself in it. You know, be one of them, think like one of them, and you'd be very surprised, you know, how rewarding and rich it can be. Because I, for example, you know, was able to do that, and I just dived in, and I've met a lot of people there, Americans and very different nationalities, who lived there for many years and didn't speak and didn't, you know, they still enjoyed the country, but it's not the same as perceiving it from within that culture. And I think that, you know, whether it's Asian or a European country, it's just in Asia, it's so much more for Westerner, you know, it's the difference is much more obvious, right? But it's the same for me in the UK. You see, I didn't do that because I underestimated the differences. And it's only then when it hit me that actually I haven't really become British yet. I tried to do everything to try to change them. Yeah, so what's the point of going there? So it's the same with Asian countries. In India, even in Japan, the cultures within different areas are very different.
Hmm. But being curious and really doing a deep dive and being open and curious definitely helps to have a good start.
So, you know, just accept for what it is, the best of it. So, yeah, just pick a location and immerse yourself in that and be one with them, be local to them, you know. So, because Japan is a big country, Tokyo is a big city, but, you know, find yourself in izakaya where you come home and like in cheers and they still, you know, remember your name, they know who you are, you emotionally connect. That's kind of what I did. And me and my husband used to go and drink sake with them and chat. That was kind of awesome, really.
Yeah, cool. Anna Maria, you have been in top management positions now since many years. And I'm wondering, how did you define success before rising to a C-level position and now after getting there? Did it change throughout the time?
Oh, well, but I never saw it that way. You know, so I don't know what it is for me. I've never had an aspiration to climb up.
Mm-hmm.
Which really, I guess, and that came up actually on the leadership development program on my previous company. We went in this high-flying leadership development program, and there were a lot of exercises, and it was very rewarding for me to interact with people. And I, you know, I met people outside of HR again. You know, business really, HR is about that to support the business, so it was amazing for me. And I think it must have been before the last sort of day, people said, so there was a guy who actually went to interview with the CEO in the middle of this leadership development program. And he said, yeah, we're gonna, you know, we all, you know, we're here on the path, you know. And then they asked me, okay, but, you know, you're really lovely, but we don't know what's your ambition. And I was thinking, wow, good question. I don't think I have one. And seriously, there is a funny story to this. So, you know, I told you that I wanted to be a child psychologist when I was a child. But there was also other part of me. I saw a couple of movies and these women in a nice cute suits, you know, prancing around in their high heels and looking very important and busy and doing some exciting things. I didn't really understand what they were doing. And I thought, oh, that'd be really cool to be one of them one day. And I don't forget, I think it must have been 2007 or 8. I stood in Prague in a hotel. I was getting ready for work. I looked at myself and I said, oh my God, I have become that person. And then I thought, how did this happen to me? So, you know, for me, it was always about the passion of what I do and wanting to do more. And that's how kind of I ended up. Now, I'd be totally lying if I didn't realize at some point in time that the higher up you are, the more influence you have. And that's actually a very cute delusion, because then you realize that that's not true either. Because corporate world doesn't operate this way. And I'd realize that all of us, and actually it's really through the personality and the energy that you really give off that people follow that, and that you can make the biggest change that way. But because the way corporations are, it does help to be the boss to be able to do that, as long as you don't get caught in this, you know, I know better now, because that can happen to people, and then stifle kind of the ideas and the growth of people that are coming young into a team and, you know, from different environments and have different ideas. So no, to answer to your question, I didn't really have a career path or plan like that. I've never really been thinking about success that way. And I know it's a bit shocking, but I really didn't. It was more about the feeling and the doing and the enjoying.
Yeah, but that's something that you can call success, which is great, right? Having an impact, influence, and so on. So this is how you define success, which is perfect, I would say.
I guess so. I've never kind of thought about it in terms of success, but yes.
Was that like this, like since the early days, or would you say this changed in regards to looking at what is giving you the feeling of success in what you do?
Yes, I think there was a moment in my life that I had to become a bit more corporate and politically savvy. Otherwise, my definition of success would no longer work. There was a situation in my life where somebody pulled me aside and said, yeah, you're going to have to change, because if you carry on like this and we need you, you know, you're not going to be very successful here, because that's not how this works. And then I was given insight into this corporate whole engine, politics and structure of how things work. Mm-hmm. So I had to, I guess, it's a bit like leave the Peter Pan land, the Netherlands. And I had to become what I maybe judged, because I thought, I don't want to be like that, actually. Funny enough, you know, it's turning into a counseling session. And so, yes, it has changed. I became less innocent and became more aware of it. And it took me maybe 2 or 3 years to realize that just because I'm aware of it doesn't mean I have to be tarnished by it, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And funny enough, I was given a leadership coach, and that really helped. She helped me overcome this taste towards, you know, politics and the aspect that I didn't like about my job, but then I wouldn't be able to do my job and, you know, thrive and do what I like. So that was very healing for me. And so the definition of success really, I guess, changed in that respect, mm-hmm. that I had to do certain things to be able to be who I am in a slightly different way.
This actually brings me to one last question. What in your life creates or contributes to a feeling of satisfaction and meaningfulness?
Well, so the satisfaction for me is if I can contribute and learn myself and help others but in the past when I was younger, funny enough, I was a bit bent on I would look at the person and think, oh, you know, I've experienced that, I should help them, but they were not ready for that, right? So that wasn't very helpful. You know, being myself and bringing along those that, you know, feel aligned to that cause or to their way of life, or their way of being, whether it's a conversation, whether it's a coaching session, or whether it's an HR project, and then achieving this, whether together or alone or in partnership, you know, depending on the situation. So satisfaction is really, it's about enjoying what I do and certain amount of growth and progress that benefits me and others.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thanks so much for sharing all this, Anna Maria. It was fun. It was really fun listening to you and your stories. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you. And, you know, it wasn't all rosy, right? I have shed a few tears too, so.
Yeah, that's part of every change process or every new step you take. And but I think you have given us good insights on the stuff that also was challenging and that in the end still brought you where you are today.
Absolutely. I wouldn't change a thing.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. And yes, I would love to talk to you about Tokyo and other things.
Looking forward. Anna Maria, have a good afternoon.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Ciao. You've liked this episode and know someone for whom this topic is relevant and you personally wish for to find his or her path and start the journey? I would be super happy if you would recommend this podcast. Thanks a lot for your time today and have a great day ahead.